The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm glad you've joined me this Saturday afternoon. It's February 16th, 2013. I want to remind you that I'll be taking phone calls. I'm looking at the sound here. I guess I'm not sounding very loud. Let me check my... All right. I'm taking phone calls in the second hour at 1-830-443-4911. You can also send me an email at carolyn@carolynyeager.net. I have one now, but I'll wait a little bit till I get underway here till we get to what this emailer is talking about. Or maybe he just wanted to let me know, give me some information before I started the show, so that I would take his ideas in view. But anyway, I'm going to be talking today about the Holocaust. I'm going to be talking about World War II. I'm going to be talking about the so-called German crimes and atrocities and so on, which I know that most of you listening to me now and who will be listening to me know is a bunch of phony baloney and know the truth about it. But one thing that has that convinced me or that caused me to want to do this topic today is that I'm going to be talking about, when I get to it, about this person named Herb Stolpman. And as I said in my announcement, you know, I ran into him over at Scrapbook Pages blog, where he comes on every so often, and he's treated respectfully by the owner of that blog, as this owner treats everybody respectfully, including me. he's that kind of a person, and I've known him for a long time. I consider him a friend, even though we've never met in person. And also in some years when I first wrote to him about his Scrapbook Pages website, he was very nice, and we started corresponding after that and so on. But I've gotten very, very irritated by this Stolpman, and I've written and asked him things which he doesn't answer. And so I had looked at his website, but his blog, which is called Dachau KZ. But I didn't, I never really read it all. I looked it over and, didn't like it. And then, I was asking him these questions and he didn't answer. And I thought, well, I better check out his blog more closely to see what exactly he said and hasn't said. And I wanted, rather than, since I had kind of brought this all up over there at Scrapbook Pages blog, I thought, that I should, cover everything that I've learned about him, because a lot of the things that I was asking him are answered on his blog, although it's here, there, everywhere. It's kind of, you know, mixed up and not put together in an organized way, but I didn't want to do all that, and so I thought about writing a blog of my own on my own website. And then I thought, well, I didn't have anything for today's program, so I would do it on the program today and then maybe write something from this. So I've been checking him out quite a bit, and I think it's going to be pretty interesting. So I hope you will continue listening and see what I found out about him. I want to start out, though, with talking about Vladimir Putin of Russia. Was it just yesterday, maybe, or the day before, whatever, I saw that he had been, he had made a speech in Israel, attacking, what he calls, criminal attempts to rewrite World War II history. And, you know, he's spoken about that before, and, Russia is absolutely adamant, in their nationalistic stance that there will be no change in the history, that the Russians were the good guys in the war and were defending themselves against the evil Nazis who invaded their country. And they also are totally against any equal, what they call equalization of the Soviet Russian crimes and the Nazi Germany crimes. They don't go for that at all. And this is the way it is when you are a true nationalist. And I'm going to mention Greece in this regard too, in a minute, because the Golden Dawn Party in Greece. When your interest is in mainly your own country and its well-being and supporting it, you're not going to accept anything that causes it to look not so good very easily. You're not going to do that very easily. And Putin has, don't think that Putin is interested in truth. He's interested in what's good for Russia. And Golden Dawn is going to be interested and is interested in what's good for Greece, first and foremost. And this is, I always say that I don't find fault with that, because I understand that people are going to do that. And as long as the country that I associate myself with and that I feel is my own country does the same, but my countries are not so good at that, because the United States is not a true nationalist country. It's a globalist thinking country. And of course, Germany, that I relate to so much, is totally made to and under the control of leaders that are totally anti-nationalist and will never ever stand up for all of German history, and will continue to be taking the blame for everything that happened in World War II. So this is where my problem lies, and this is what I want to point out here today in regard to, as when I talk about Stoltman. So in this article, Putin says, a quote, there's a quote here: "The rewriting of history is a crime to the millions who died for the victory and the next generations who must know the true heroes of World War II and be able to tell between the truth and the impudent and cynical lies." And he said this in the Israeli town of Netanya, where a monument to Soviet soldiers who defeated Nazi Germany was unveiled on Monday. He said, quote, "We must do the utmost to keep bygone the criminal Nazi doctrines, no matter under which camouflage they may come, and to make inviolable the judgments of the Nuremberg Tribunal." Now, you know, what would be nice if one could actually ask Putin and get an answer as to what are the criminal Nazi doctrines. What doctrines did they have? I understand he didn't like them invading Russia, but what doctrines did they have? I guess he would mean racial doctrines, and that's, they had some doctrines of the superiority of the German and Aryan races over what would be the Slavic races, which the Russians come under. But there's a lot to be said about that. It's not black and white. It's not cut and dried. And a lot of this has been falsely presented. So it would be nice to discuss this, but he's not about to, because that would mean that he would have to open himself and open history to a different interpretation. And they like the interpretation the way it is. So in my mind, we, those of us who really want the truth about this, and I want the truth about the World War II era, because I want Germany to be seen in a more accurate and better light. That's I admit that. I don't like the way it is because, and I don't think it's the truth. I know it's not the truth, but I might not care so much about the truth when it comes to some country or some people somewhere that I don't feel connected to, and I don't feel it's my job to worry about it. You know, it's their job. So I do accept that people are going to care about their own and not be open to the, always open to the truth if it's not going to be good for them. So therefore I say that we who are, have an interest in this need to, an interest in truth for Germany, need to increase our efforts and never let up to bring the real truth out that we see as the real truth, because these forces against it are doubling up their efforts. I mean, when Putin goes to Israel in order to emphasize this and allies in this area only, I'm saying, I'm not saying that by going to Israel, he has, you know, he's somehow connecting up with Israel and the Jews. He doesn't want the Jews in his country, but he doesn't mind. He's going to, you know, he's going to be and have good relations with Israel as a nation and speak, you know, fairly, whatever he might call it, about Jews internationally. He's not going to go along the anti-Jewish line, but he doesn't, but he still doesn't want those, want Jews to take over his country. But what happened was in Israel, they put up this big monument in this town of Netanya, as I already said, to these Soviet soldiers who defeated the Nazis. So naturally, it was unveiled. They invited him. Naturally, he sort of had to go, and otherwise he'd be insulting the Israelis and say something. And so this is what he said. And he said also, I don't think I read this one yet, we must cherish and defend the truth about that war. Yeah, the truth about that war. And oppose attempts to justify Nazi abettors. We will never allow executors and their victims. No, it should be executors. No, executors. Those who, executors and their victims to be made equals. The distortion of the truth and replacement of it with various falsifications and conjectures. Then he said, I don't know what this monument looked like. I just saw a picture of him. I didn't actually look it up to find out. He says, the uplifting white dove with white dove's wings symbolize the victory of good and peace. Let these great eternal values always be the solid foundation of relations between our countries, friendship between our countries and our peoples. Now, he said this to Israel, in Israel, but at the same time, it's just words that say, you know, good relations between our countries and our people. He doesn't, you know, it doesn't go too far, actually, considering who he is and what he's speaking for. And he said that he was impressed with the ceremony, which strengthened his respect for the Jewish people, the people of Israel. And he said, we are grateful for everything that commemorates people who died in that war. So, you know, they commemorated the Soviets who died in their country of Israel, because that's in their interest. And so, you know, he says they're grateful for that. Well, you know, I don't, as I said, I don't hold that against Putin, but I don't have any illusions about him either. So I'll go to Golden Dawn, and, you know, somebody brought to my attention recently. Let me go to this page here, the Golden Dawn website, where they have a page, the program of their program. And their program is, it's pretty interesting to read that. I would read it. I haven't read it all. I didn't have time, but it should be read, probably. And they say that they're right at the top, that their first goal is national independence. And they talk a lot about nationalism and how to be independent and so on. And the person that sent this one was because of a section way down at the bottom where they talk about religion, and Golden Dawn says, I'll just read it since I'm mentioning it. the Golden Dawn is opposed to church-state separation. She seeks to restore the prestige of the church and to remove all the decadent and internationalist members of the clergy. Religions that offend the Greek tradition and history and damage the strength of the nation will be banned. Greek Orthodoxy, reborn once again, will be a pioneer in the struggles of the nation. Well, I suppose this makes me feel even more when I see people being able to belong to a nationalist party and be nationalist, and even in some countries their president is nationalist, while not pushing that word too much, it still basically is. When I think of Germany and how unnationalist it is, and how particularly like with this with the Dresden anniversary a few days ago, and how they just absolutely equate any intimation of nationalism with something evil and bad and Nazism, which is stamped out, and that this city, Dresden, when it does its own commemoration for the Dresden bombing, it has from the beginning included in that commemoration Coventry in England, and I think it's Hiroshima in Japan. You know, they can't even commemorate their own, that one of the probably the most terrible atrocities that ever took place in the world, and the most hideous suffering that was caused to the people right there in Dresden. They can't even do that without saying, well, it's, you know, we equate it with Coventry in England and the German bombing of Coventry, which was nothing like what happened in Dresden, not even close. I mean, it's an insult to their own people, but that's what they do. So going to Herb Stoltman now, he is a German, and if you go to look at his blog, dachaukz.blogspot.com, dachaukz.blogspot.com. You know, I would suggest if you're at your computer, just go ahead and go over there, see what it looks like. At the top, he's got a banner, and his picture is on it. It's supposed to be his picture from when he was after the war, but when he was in living in Dachau, not as a prisoner, but as an employee of the United States military. One thing I want to say is that in a comment at Scrapbook Page's blog, he wrote, I do search the net for relevant information, speaking about his blog, but most comes from a number of foreign books. Although I am almost fluent in four languages plus two others, I understand, yes, Yiddish is one of them. Gee, I am not saying that this guy is a Jew. He sure doesn't look like it. He looks like a Prussian. I think he is the sort of a Prussian or a Northern German. But he's fluent in four languages plus two others, and Yiddish is one of them. But he says, but he can barely write proper English, and he excuses so much of what he writes by saying, or other people excuse him, actually. Further Glory at Scrapbook Pages has excused him as saying, by saying that he doesn't know English that well. Well, you know, he was an interpreter for the U.S. military. He knew English quite well. He worked even during the war with the Germans. At the very end there, he was used as an interpreter. He should know it well, and plus in 1956 he emigrated to New Zealand with and married a woman there. I don't know what her nationality is though exactly, because she also emigrated or left. I don't know. She left. He met her in Dachau, I guess. This is after the war, not during the war. You know, not when it was under the Germans. And he's lived there ever since. He worked for Ford Motor Company. and not in a lowly position, because he has a picture of himself on one of his blog posts where he's in a meeting, standing there with Henry Ford II, I think he's the second, who had come to the plant in New Zealand and was standing there, and a bunch of people standing around, all in suits and so on, and he was one of them. I couldn't quite tell which one he was from his description, but so he had some kind of a, you know, managerial type position, I guess. And then he worked for another plastics company there. He's still in New Zealand. He's elderly. He's in his 80s, I guess. But, you know, he ought to know English pretty well. So I do sometimes think that he's just sloppy in his writing and doesn't even edit or try to make it better. But I'm going to start. If you go there, you will, and you look on the right side on the menu, on the right side, you will see it down at the bottom, the earliest post. And he has one called My Discharge Papers from POW Camp. This is, well, let me take a look here since I'm mentioning it to you. Oh, now I went and lost it. This is under, I think, the first one, not 2010, but 2011. And it was posted on Friday, March 4th, 2011. And this is one of the first things I looked at, because I was asking him how he got to Dachau, what he was doing there, and what he was doing in the war, and, you know, all this stuff he never answered. But he's got these two items here, and you can enlarge the second one. I don't know if they're two sides of the same page, paper, or if they're two different papers, but to me they're very strange if they're discharge papers, because there's no date anywhere for when he was discharged, unless I'm blind and can't see anything. His birth date and birthplace is what he blurs out, so you can't read it. He thinks he needs to do that for identity theft. But that's not important, his birth date and birthplace. What's important is the date of his discharge. But I don't see it, and it seems like a very odd-looking discharge paper. Of course, he was discharged. He got it from the Americans in 1946. It's supposed to be from January 1946. But, you know, I have some questions about that, but I don't know what these papers would have looked like. But it seems to me it'd have to have a date. There's no date. But he says it's January 1946. So that answers that, if that's true. Now, going on to his next blog post after that, these are his early ones where he's talking about his own experiences during the war and after the war. And on March 15th, 2011, he posted My Own Surrender to the 3rd U.S. Army, 9th May 1945. But in this particular one, there's not a word. There's stuff about other surrenders, and it's a little bit about Hitler Youth members who were treated very badly by the Americans. And he talks about one being executed, this one named Heinz Petri, when he was only 16 years old, and that there was three of them that they executed, and there was really no reason to execute these kids. But he said the chairman of the military court said that the German military and political leaders force us to do this, to fight fire with fire and blood with blood. We will not tolerate those responsible to hide behind women and children, you know, stuff like that. And so he sentenced them to death, and they were executed. Well, that's only one little tiny wrong that the Americans did amongst this huge, huge pile of atrocities and atrocious activities and absolute savage behavior carried out by the Americans. So I'll go on. That was not too much in that one about him. But he does mention this stuff later on. So then he posts on March 21st, 2011, My Training. And he says that he was called up to become a Hilfsausbilder, which is an instructor's helper or assistant instructor, in December 1944 at Friedrichstrasse in Berlin. So, you know, he was like about 16 at the time, or maybe he was a little older than that. But he was still in school. I think, though, he was in higher education by then. But he was called up like everybody, all these younger people in Germany were at the end there to serve, to defend their homeland. And I want to compare him to a friend that has become a friend of mine through Willie Chrisman, who was a friend of Willie Chrisman's. And now he has written a story of his experience, which was at the same time. He was 17 and then 18 years old when he, at the very end of the war, like in the beginning of 1945, he was in the Hitler Youth, and he was called up first as a flak to a flak station, but then later he had to do more. And that was when he was still in school. They were serving as, now and then as at the flak, what do you call that? In a flak regiment, but to, you know, help the shooting down the planes that were coming over. But then he was assigned to actual, combat. And, he wrote about in a long article about his experience. It's just wonderful. And, I have, finally got it edited, which, I failed to do before Willie Chrisman died. Well, he wanted me to, but I was too busy. But now I've got it done, and you know, it's been sent to the Barnes Review. I'm hoping that they will publish it first. If they don't, I will soon have it on my website. But in this, Willie Wenger had terrible experiences, but he does not ever complain. He does not ever blame the military or the Germans or Hitler or anything like that for it. He also lost his beloved brother at the very end of the war. So a lot of things happened at the end. A lot of deaths occurred among the Germans who were fighting, a lot of them, because they were in a kind of a hopeless battle there. But still, he said that they did feel they wanted to defend their homeland. But this guy, Herb Stoltman, He has nothing good to say about anybody that's German, but he has lots good to say about the Americans. So, you know, he was kind of, he wasn't too happy about the position he was put in. And it's true these young kids were put in a bad position. They weren't prepared to do what they are asked to do. That's another argument. I'll leave that for maybe somebody who wants to call in and say so. But he says that he was given papers to go by train to the 5th Reichsausbildungslager. That's a camp for these instructors, helpers, and so on, where they were given training in Slovakia. And he said they were run by the SS. He really doesn't like the SS. He said the total number of trainees included about 500 boys, aged 16 to 19. And I can't, you know, I have to just go to the important parts here. He said, you know, he starts in, he was in a group of seven. You know, they were divided up into sections and smaller, and then he was in this group of seven. He says they had a rather fanatic NCO by the name of Hess, who was an Unterscharf. He says, and this, you see, he just comes up with things out of the blue without really explaining. He says, my offense was that I had copied a number of a love letter that was a love letter in quotes that was quite innocent unless you read every second line, which was of a sexual nature. What he means, if you read between the lines, it was of a sexual nature. It was supposed to be a love letter, but it was sexual. And he was reported for that, and he had degraded the honor of the Germanic womanhood. So what kind of a kid was this anyway? You know, why is he's in the midst of this tremendously important and stressful and was, you know, the, where his country is about ready to be defeated by terrible enemies. And he's sending out, he's copying and giving out love, you know, sexual things that he says that he got that somehow did not speak well for the honor of Germanic womanhood. But then he says, in parentheses, there was not much honor left after being raped by the Russians. You know, I thought that was an incredibly revealing statement by this guy, to say that. You know, the Russian, by the time he is involved in this, a lot of this raping had already taken place. And he is now saying that there's no honor left in these women who were raped. So what difference does it make? You know, this is a really a crude, rude attitude that he shows in this simple little comment here. But he says he received some punishments, like carrying a rock while running and crawling in the mud and so on. Now, you know, for doing this. Well, it was right to give him these punishments, but it didn't seem to make any impression on him. So he says, after the successful completion of training, he was sent to a camp, it's got a long name, of a Wehrmacht camp, of some kind of a Wehrmacht camp, that was run by Commander Hauptmann Stürmer, to teach the use of the Panzerfaust to young and old, partly Volkssturm men. You know, is where they were calling up, not to go to the front or anything, but to defend their cities in Germany, and they were calling up the young kids and the old men, who are only ones who were left there, how to use the Panzerfaust, some big tank gun, and how to defend, how to do this. And this is what this young guy, who though had some, I guess, college education and was supposed to be able to learn things fast, was supposed to be doing. He says, that even though they were told their soldier book said they were members of the Wehrmacht, they didn't necessarily wear those uniforms because they didn't fit them. So they were wearing some kind of Luftwaffen outfits, he said, that were colored in the blue color. My unit was the 12th Panzer Vernichtungsbrigade, which was in part decimated during the fighting after the Americans crossed the Rhine at Remagen. So he says, to refill our ranks, members of the Hitler Youth and Jungvolk were forced into combat with disastrous consequences. Well, in some cases, that's absolutely true. He says, anyone taken prisoner by the American forces were shot without mercy. I myself saw the bodies unearthed out of a shallow grave in the vicinity of the Harz Mountains. He said they were, and you know, he tells a lot of the things that the Americans did to the Germans that they didn't need to do and shouldn't have done. He never seems to hold it against them, but he holds everything against the Germans, his own people. Of course, we'll come up with that with a little more about reasons for that later. He says they were pushed back toward the Czech border. It was decided to surrender part of the brigade, and except for 15 men and one lieutenant, and he was a part of that group that didn't surrender, and they roamed through the Sudeten Mountains until we heard of the unconditional surrender of Germany and became POWs under Eisenhower and in a number of his death camps. And he says that the 1.7 million Germans died of starvation, according to the figures. Yet he says, I doubt this figure, although I had been eating grass and my weight was down to 50 kilograms. There was no Red Cross or the Geneva Convention for us. Well, there's a lot that could be said about all that, too. But most of you are familiar with that, and that's not my subject for today. But he says that he was in one of those Eisenhower camps, not in the worst one, obviously, because he got out of it in a fairly short order. But he says he experienced it, but he doesn't talk too much about it, although he does describe some things about it. He said, let me see here. Oh, then he has to add at the bottom of this particular post, for what reason, I don't know, and I don't believe him. He says at the bottom, seven or eight SS instructors. This is about when he was, you know, in this little school thing before he surrendered. Were unmarried, and all of them had rather attractive Jewish girlfriends working within the military installation. He says, it shows you when boy meets girl and the chemistry is right, religion, color, or creed does not matter. They taught the official NS party line, National Socialist Party line. When it came to their private life, though, it was a different story. Well, you know, okay, I don't believe it. All the unmarried instructors had Jewish girlfriends, and they were working within the military installation. This is the kind of thing he comes out with without any proof. It's just him saying it, which leads me to feel that he has this, definitely has this agenda too, or just an instinct that he can't stop himself, or he can't control, to put down any. Of course, he's not putting down Germans. He's putting down National Socialists and SS. And this is something that he just keeps doing. So on March 21st, 2011, he enters a post called Military Training and Punishments. This is where he goes into more detail. And he says now that he had distributed leaflets which came close to pornography during his basic training. Now, I don't know if this is the same one he referred to before or a different one. But, you know, to say that he was distributing leaflets which came close to pornography, and then it's going to come out that he was a ministry student. He was a religion student. And he talks about that. Now, why is he doing this? Is he so naive, or did he have such an attitude? I really don't understand it, but it says that his punishment was supervised by an officer, yet we received explicit instruction in sex education held by officers, professionals on the subject. Then he says one of our men was engaged, he means they're young men, people like himself, he was 19. He was engaged to be married, and Hess would never, that's their leader, you know, that he mentioned before, Hess, would never give up to degrade him in any way possible. Well, I don't know what way he was doing that, because he doesn't say. Then he says, most of us were theology students. So I guess they took a bunch of these kids from his school or class or whatever, and that's who he was with, and he says they were theology students. Yet he says he's distributing leaflets that were close to pornography. But he says, then he accuses this Hess of punching and hitting boys and would not accept the NS doctrine and stuff like that. He says the training was harsh and brutal. Two boys committed suicide. I don't know. Again, you know, it's just him saying this. So what can we say about it? This was, he says, that the leaders, instructors and so on, didn't care because this was their way of getting rid of those that didn't fit in. Just, you know, drive them to suicide. So he says, some of the boys, again, he's going on, some of the boys were deeply religious. And when it came to practicing genick shush, shooting, which is to shoot someone in the back of the neck. But wasn't that a Soviet practice? I mean, I don't know that it's ever been shown that the Germans were practiced this shooting in the back of the neck. But this is what he's saying, that they were practicing this on dummies. And that when they were doing that, he was thinking of the commandment, you shall not kill. Because, you know, he was a theology student. I don't know what he thinks you're going to do in wartime, but there's a little bit more about this, I think, coming up, or if not, I will just say that, you know, this is war, and you certainly don't want your soldiers to have the belief you shall not kill. But he's acting like this is, you know, was some kind of they were going against this commandment by teaching these kids to kill and to shoot other people. So under executions in the same post, but executions by U.S. forces. He says, I do not know what treatment was dished out when taking prisoner in Hitler Youth uniform. I never saw anyone in a POW camp. Well, you know, at the one time he says he never saw a Hitler Youth uniform. He said nobody was in those uniforms that he was around. He was in a Luftwaffe uniform, I guess. So then he says only briefly, well, he's saying when they were in the Harz region and they retreated because an American column was advancing. this is not too important. He says, only briefly, I had no rank but was addressed as Hilfsausbilder. Oh, briefly, he was billeted with a nice family for a couple of days in the vicinity south of Limburg under Lahn. I guess at that time, see, he jumps around. At that time, the German military was, you know, entreating or forcing whatever families to take in some soldiers for periods of time when they were in the area into their homes. And he said that they always were acted like they were hiding something, and they had two sons, and that he had to take the sons. That's what he says. He took their sons, I guess, to be soldiers. I don't know. He doesn't make that clear at all. Most of the, so here he goes again to his theology, one's own faith. Most of the intake were high school students, some of us in midterm studying theology, thus taught by the commandment not to kill. Although Nietzsche said, Gott ist tot, well, you know, God is dead, and whatever else Nietzsche said there, gibt nur einen, I don't know what the Uber mentioned, something about the higher man that didn't need God, I guess. So he says some strongly believed in God. So he's claiming that it was one of the functions of the instructors. He's back in his own, you know, schooling again, to deprogram us of what was a necessity in wartime, to shoot and kill your fellow man. Well, of course, it's not your fellow man in wartime, it's your enemy. And if you're going to think about your enemy as your fellow man, you're not going to be a soldier. Well, this guy didn't want to be a soldier, obviously. He just kept bringing up the theology part of it, but he doesn't seem to be a truly spiritual person. Anyway, he's kind of a nasty person. And he says, but he says that they break you. He said it was their intention in this school where he went to be an instructor to break you of your belief in God. And I don't think so at all. I don't know. This was not common with German soldiers not to believe in God. In fact, they provided him with church services and all of that stuff. So, I mean, it's just, he's nuts. He says, with the exception of one boy, these experts were successful, but only down to the age of 3 to 4. It was impossible to break you of the first little prayer that a mother, you know, that you learned as a child. Oh, what's that got to do with it? You know, and he repeats this little child's prayer, as though his whole innocence was destroyed by the German military. And he says, P.S., I failed after the war to get back to full study as a missionary. So he was studying, according to him, to be a missionary. He was so into the religious angle. But that destroyed it for him. He says that afterwards, I guess, sometime, somewhere, he doesn't say where, he says, the panel of three pastors told me that I failed on one point only, I guess, failed to get back into the missionary. You do not believe in God, they told him. Well, that was the end of his belief in God. Probably wasn't very strong to begin with. So on Monday, March 21st, 2011, a bunch of these were all posted on Monday, March 21st. I wondered about that. But, you know, he could have written them up and then posted them in separate, you know, entries on that day, which is what he did, because he couldn't have written all this in that one day, I don't believe. Unless, because most of this is his own writing, whereas later he just copies stuff from propaganda books and so on. So this one is entitled Sondorf, POW Camp to Dachau, KZ. So this one tells us more about him. It answers some of the questions that I had from him. He says that the morning of May the 8th, the final act or surrender was signed in Berlin together with the Russians. He'd mentioned that on the 7th, that on the 4th, Dönitz signed the surrender. That's what he says. And that on the 8th, it was the one with the Russians. I don't know if he's got those dates right. But then he says, at that time, May the 8th, my platoon of 15 boys and one officer, Lieutenant Becker, marched towards the German border from within Czechoslovakia in the area of Schüttenhofen. Now, these guys hadn't surrendered yet, his little group. And he says, they had an order to do so, I guess, but they didn't adhere to it. He said, as we had thrown all our weapons down to comply with Dönitz's command, except our lieutenant, that might have been, according to him, on the 4th of May, 45, except our lieutenant who carried his MP-38 to protect us to some degree against Czech partisans' ambushes, when we met the first American soldiers confronting a massive column of tired and dejected Germans that all were having to avoid capture by the Russians. That is, there is a big column of Germans walking to the west, trying to avoid the Russians. We know that was taking place. Everybody was trying to get to the Americans or the British, not knowing how badly they were going to be treated by these factions, but they didn't want to fall in the hands of the Russians either. It was kind of a no-win situation there. He said he didn't see his lieutenant after that, but they met up with these American soldiers, and so they were briefly searched and put onto trucks into the direction of a small village, which they later found out was called Sondorf, S-O-N-N-D-O-R-F, in the Bavarian woods. They were dumped on a large unplowed potato field that was slightly sloping down into an expansive meadow, which was dissected by a freshwater river. He said on the other side of the river, there was a German field hospital. So they didn't feel too bad, but he says, as more youths arrived, we were all herded into so-called sections. This seems to be a bunch of young people that he was put together with. That's what it seems to be, but can't say for sure. And they were separated from any NCOs. Something commissioned officers. Or likely officers that might have been slipped in with us. They wanted to separate these kids from the officers, according to him, for the older people, or from any of their leaders, so that they weren't being advised by them. At that time, he said they didn't know that Eisenhower had issued an order on March 10th, 1945, that German prisoners of war be pre-designated as disarmed enemy forces, DEF, and that Eisenhower ordered that these Germans did not fall, or stated, you know, put it in an order that these Germans did not fall under the Geneva Convention and were not to be fed or given water or medical attention. The Swiss Red Cross was not to inspect the camps, and they had, under the DEF classification, the Red Cross had no such authority or jurisdiction. This is all known, and, you know, he says so. But even though he's going to be telling a lot of what the Americans did to him and his fellow Germans, he still ends up loving the Americans and not the Germans. But I think, and I don't think it's a matter of the syndrome. What's that called? The Swedish Stockholm syndrome. I don't think it's that. I think it's just his hatred. And I think he was brought up that way, too, in a family like that, of Hitler and the Nazis. So he can't seem to get over that. No matter what he saw being done, how unfair they were being treated and how much propaganda everything is, which he uses in this blog later on, even though at times, as I will get to, he has learned differently, mostly from the Scrapbook Pages blog. And so then he puts in an update where he tells the truth about some things, whereas before he had no idea because he never looked for it. He was only looking for one thing to blame. To blame the National Socialists for everything, and as being as brutal as the propaganda said they were. Now he says that at Sandorf, there were no facilities of any kind except an old abandoned farmhouse and stable, which became the headquarters for the American interrogators and guards. And he says that there were some more experienced soldiers had been at the Eastern Front, who immediately started to dig a pit so they could relieve themselves. These older guys knew what was up, but and he says, you know, well, we've described these things before, how they have a rough tree trunk there, and you sit there, and everybody sits there and out in the open and does their business. He does mention that later on they got lime from the Americans to avoid spreading disease, because they were afraid of, everybody was afraid of an epidemic. And he said that he managed to have this German army triangular tent sheets, which was quite unique. See, something the Germans had given their soldiers and their young soldiers, that it had an opening in the center that you could make a protective waterproof jacket out of it. And he slept on that for a few days, but then he got together four others and they dug a hole and they put this they put this thing all together and looked like a pyramid, and they protected themselves in that way from the weather, although he said the weather was pretty good. Food was our main problem. We didn't have any. And then he says that he did, as others, boiled dandelions in a tin over open fire. It was a bitter taste, but I managed to swallow it. And I think, you know, what a pussy, because I love dandelions. Dandelions are delicious, especially if you cook them, but they're even good if you eat them raw, which I can do, which I prefer to do, although, I mean, they taste even better when they're cooked. But he was such a spoiled thing that he, you know, finding dandelions to eat would have been a great thing, but I'm sure that in no time, in a short time, all the dandelions were picked and there wasn't any left. But he mentions that, and he says that he was so weak he couldn't even get up any longer. And he was carried into the field hospital across the river. He weighed 50 kilograms, and he was slowly nourished back to reasonable health. Well, he was a lucky one. He was carried into a field hospital. In a lot of these Eisenhower open-air camps, there was nobody taken to a hospital. People died, and they died by the millions, the hundreds of thousands, which added up to over a million. But he doesn't want to believe that number because he wasn't at those particular camps. And then he says he has permanent loss of muscle tissue in his arms ever since then. I don't know. It's my understanding that if you do exercise and stuff and eat the right things, you can build your muscle back up. I don't know if there's such a thing as permanent loss of muscle tissue, but I also think that this man is not one to do much physical exertion, as we will see. So he says when he was in that hospital, he could only account for five men which may have died from something other than starvation. And he does admit the terrible starvation that was taking place because he was a victim of it. Now, but then he says that that in this hospital, he was in a section with 30 boys, and they got a pint of watery soup with dry onions. Now, this is from the Americans. and sometimes a slice of bread per day. Now, how he was nourished back to health in that way, I don't know. But he says, but he talks about the abuse these boys received from the older soldiers. He's talking about the older German soldiers. When queuing up for our ration, he said it was terrible because they made the young boys wait. Well, this, you know, have you ever seen a dog pack or things like that? You know, the superior members, the older members and so on, they make the little puppies, even their own, wait and get what's left after they're finished. These people had been reduced to a state of primitivism. And I was thinking about this. I'll go on first, finish what he says here. He says, with bowed heads, we always had to wait our turn while they drank their soup. And then they changed their appearance by taking their caps or jackets off, and they got a second helping. And before they would let these boys get what was there, I don't know that he never says that he never got any for that reason, but he says he hopes that they'll rot in hell. Now, you know, these guys were front soldiers. They had already been through hell. I would have thought, I'll be damned if after all the hell I've been through fighting in this war, I'm going to now die of starvation in this camp, you know, and their sense of survival is so strong that they look out for themselves. And I think that's basically not anything to accuse these men of, that they were supposed to be looking out for these kids who had not done anything like what they had done. So that's my opinion on that. Well, we're going to the break, ladies and gentlemen, and I forgot to tell you that we have new music. So I'll talk about it when we get back. Enjoy it.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. I'm Carolyn, and today is February 16th, 2013, and my topic is Herb Stultman and his blog, Dachau KZ. Before I continue with that, I want to apologize for not mentioning the information about the new break music ahead of time, waiting till after, but what you heard was Ruhe Sanft, in German, Sleep Safely in translation, from Mozart's unfinished opera, Zaida. Remember, it was unfinished. It's never been performed, I guess, but some of the music from there has, and this was sung by Moshe Erdmann, E-R-D-M-A-N-N. The first name is spelled M-O-J-C-A. And I was looking real hard for music in English, but it's very hard to find the kind of music that I like, that I want to use. And I like to stick with something along the classical lines a little bit, unless it. And then I've been using so much German singers, German songs, everything in German. Well, this is in German too, but I had something in English, but it turned out there was something wrong with it, so I couldn't use it. So then I found this, and it's nice because I have a female voice finally. But it's really hard to find good songs in English. So this is if anybody has some ideas, please send them to me. You know, I'm always open to that. I do have something in line now for the next time I change, but I just changed both programs, so probably won't make a change for a while now. And I think this is a beautiful song, just beautiful, one of the most beautiful arias. In fact, it's on it's on YouTube, and if you Google it, you'll probably find it. But it's under the title of the video is Five Most Beautiful Arias in the World, or something like that. And this is one of them. I didn't find any others except this one. Well, there you go. But if you look, you'll find it. And Ruhe Sanft, Sleep Safely, Mozart's unfinished opera, Zaida, sung by Moshe Erdmann. All right, back to this story. And I want to say I really appreciate all the listeners I have listening live. I still have a lot of really necessary. I always go slower than I think I will. And I'm afraid I won't have enough, and then I have too much. So I want to try to get to some of the most important part, but I still invite listeners to call in at 830-1830-443-4911. And I should go to my email and refresh it here, too. And I will look at this. I'll just read this so that you have this information. This is from Stuart. Regarding your show today, are you aware of the Auschwitz Death Registry records published by the IHR Review back around 1993? Yes, I am. They were full of details of the deceased, place of birth, occupation, age, etc. Doesn't sound like a mass murder policy to me. My copy is in store. Well, okay. Also, at one of David Irving's meetings, I think about 2 years ago, he mentioned the radio intercepts the British had in the final days of the Third Reich when the Russians were about to overrun Auschwitz. According to the radio intercepts, when Hitler was informed of this, he expressed no great anxiety or concern that this secret would be exposed, which is to say he took a ho-hum attitude to it. And then he goes on to say the Holocaust lie is one of Jewry's great, if eroding, post-war achievements. It is their shield against any critique of their treachery against their host country. Well, it's also, that goes along with the Russians too, I would have to add. You know, people who write some of these things before they ever hear the show make some, you know, give some interesting information, but it's really not all that pertinent. But thanks, Stuart. That's from Stuart in Florida. But it's not all that pertinent to what I'm exactly talking about. So, Stultman goes on in this, March 21st, 2011 blog post about Sandorf POW camp. because it's also going to move along. I lost my place. Okay, there were no, I'm not going to read this part. I'm going to go on to what I thought was important. He goes on to say that, that the interrogation that was taking place by the GIs of the German POWs and so on, was done by German-American GIs as well as officers. Ha! I say, you know, plenty were Jewish German-Americans. They were Jewish Americans who many who had left Germany and gone to the United States and now were sent back and were in the position of lording it over these National Socialists who caused them to leave in the first place. So you can see, you know, this was another terrible aspect of what was going on. But this fellow was blind. Mr. Stoltman was just blind to this aspect of it because he's very pro-Jewish, very pro-Semitic in things that he said and so on. But in this, he writes that this interrogation went on until July 1945. And he says he was lucky enough to be taken to a Grafenau as a work team to repair potholes and roads. And they were fairly free of the military government. They were fairly free with the military government pass and two pleasant guards who directed and supervised their work. You know, always, you know, the older Germans that he has to deal with, whether they're instructors or soldiers or SS people or whatever, are always shown in the worst possible light, and they're nasty and mean and mistreat these young German kids, which I've not heard that from too many people. I've not heard that being said. But the Americans are always just so nice and wonderful, you know. And he says he was still very weak, and all he had to do was interpret. So there he's again into his interpreting work because he knows all these languages and he knows English. Obviously, because he's translating for English-speaking people. He says, we had been told by the civilian authorities. I don't know what he means by that, whether he means Germans, I guess, civilian authorities. The Germans were the civilians. That we would all be returned to our Heimat. What a lie. Well, maybe they thought that, but it didn't work out that way. They weren't in charge. So another question I have of Mr. Stoltman is why he never went home, because we're going to find that where he ended up, he wanted to stay there and he asked to stay there and he stayed there for 10 years. And he never talked about his family ever or his relatives or his home or why he didn't go home. I don't know. He said, They ended up back in Sondorf. They had huts there then. They were staying in some huts. Okay. So then he says, we were taken by trucks to Regensburg and virtually dumped into a mud field with no facilities of any sort. He had his tent still, though, and some friendly comrades and that helped him set it up. He says there were about 10,000 to 20,000 POWs at this place in Regensburg. The aim apparently was to build a proper camp, which a Hungarian company had already started. It was here later on when a rather sophisticated and well-educated German sergeant took me under his wing, and he was in charge of a six-man work team to reglaze shattered windows of a building in Regensburg. And then he talks about this fellow. He says the work was light. They did have G.I. Chow. And he talks about this fellow and then seems to think that he might have been an agent setting up safe houses and escape routes for wanted war criminals, a Nazi, you know, helping Nazis escape and so on. That's what he thought from the experience that he had, which wasn't much. He said, only once I became suspicious when he told me to ask the guard if he could go across the road to meet his wife. And when he got there, he only shook her hand And when he returned, the guard said, that was not your wife, in German. And he said, from that, he said he can only guess that he was this agent setting up safe houses. I guess, you know, he believed all those stories. There was some of that, but I don't know if this, I don't know. He, you know, again, like this, his blog is full of just making statements and comments and claims without doing any research. And what he's been accused of is not doing research. In fact, even Further Glory at Scrapbook Pages said that he doesn't know very much about it, and all he's ever done is follow the, you know, the Allied party line. So he says that he, although he was there and had all this experience, there's so much he could tell, there's so much he could do in a better way if he had the will to do it. But he says he finished up, he ended up in this Hohenbrunn south of Munich in an old KZ subcamp at an ammunition factory. They had everything there except toilets. And so he says, now here he's starting a kind of a new section, not a new section, but a new topic here. He says, it was GIs in general that saw that I was still undernourished and had pity with me, made changes, and I was able to help in their mess hall making coffee or tea for their division. Well, you know, I find this a bunch of bull. His advantage was that he spoke English. He could speak English to these GIs, and so they liked him, so he was kind of a favorite of theirs, and he played up to him, and he was looking to get a better situation for himself. I don't blame him for that, but he didn't seem to have any of this Christian sympathy for his fellow Germans. Then he said he got this full-time job in the mess hall, and it lasted from September 45 to January 46. This would have been still in Hohenbrunn, south of Munich, so he's in the Dachau area. And he did some interpreting for a friendly lieutenant who was also responsible for the POW camp, and thought that due to my youth, to give me my freedom so I could do what I liked and I don't have to obey any rules or orders and so on. So he was letting these Americans know that what his views were, that he was anti-Hitler. I'm sure he was doing this. And so that they would, you know, think he was a good kind of German and help him out. I'm sure that's how it worked out. That's how it went. So he wants to be free. He's got this idea he should be free and not have to obey any rules or orders, which he never liked showing. Like back earlier when he was passing around these sexual posters and so on. I guess that's what that was supposed to be about. Anyway, he says he was given a discharge. This is where his discharge comes from. This lieutenant, he doesn't even name him. I think somewhere later on he names him. A friendly lieutenant saw to it that he got a discharge into civilian life in January 1946. And he says, what a culture shock. So then he says he was being treated by the civilian, that is German population, down there in around Munich, as a Prussian refugee. That's what he was. He was from up there somewhere. And so they thought that he was a refugee from there, and they resented because all these refugees were coming in to Bavaria, because Bavaria was better off than any other part of Germany. They wanted to, all these people were flooding in and using up resources and wanting to move into every place there was and so on. And the Bavarian government was allowing it, but the people were resenting it to a certain degree. And so he's saying that that's how they felt about him. And probably his accent and all that, you know, would have given him away. And he was staying with the family. He says, you know, so they put him with the family. He's staying with the family that had a fairly large slaughterhouse and never suffered that much through the war. but he says the treatment he received from them was unbelievably shocking. I guess they, you know, they would put these, they would place people in with families. And some of these families didn't like it. They might have had some others there, too. I don't know, but I've read some stories that it was a real intrusion. It's like during in Russia, in the Soviet, when the Bolsheviks were doing that, they would the people who had the middle class people and also upper class people who had larger homes, they were just piling all these Bolshevik communist peasants in there with them, taking over their whole house where they had just a little room or two for themselves. And they were supposed to just accept that with equanimity because this was, you know, this is the system. But it just was almost impossible to live that way, particularly when people don't have the same habits that you have and are just taking, you know, taking charge of your house and making themselves at home everywhere and your stuff and your belongings. I'm sorry. You know, I don't go for that. But he says that, you know, he didn't like it there. And so he was still able to work in the mess hall as in the same mess hall for the Americans. That was his job. He still had that. So he asked this friendly lieutenant to let him come back into the POW camp because he was happier there. But the lieutenant said that he couldn't do that. It's already been done, I guess. So he says there's another camp in Taufkirchen where Hauptmann Heinrich has given me his word of honor that none of his soldiers will escape and have free movement. So he will see if you can stay there. And so he went to this other POW camp, took all his belongings with him, which was clothing that had been given to him by well-meaning and caring GIs. Oh yeah. And then, as the administration of Hohenbrunn went into civilian control, and he says, I was sick of jackboots and clicking heels. Again, a reference to how much he dislikes the German manner. And that was not just national. That was not just Hitlerism. That was Prussianism in large part, very military style way of doing things. But he didn't like it. And he says that he went to Allach near Munich, Allach, where there was a U.S. ordnance maintenance shop, and he got a job at their supply depot. He said an officer junior grade by the name of Milton Plyer walked into the personnel office while he was there, and the lady asked him if he had any vacancy for this young man, and he asked him some questions. Then he told him to come back in 2 days, and this Plyer fired the German that he had working for him and gave the job to Stoltman. I guess Stoltman was more pleasing to him as an American. He was an American. And he said Plyer very, very rarely ever spoke to him, but he was fluent in German. And he stayed there in this supply depot working until they were transferred to the Dachau KZ in 1947-48. And when he was with his job transferred to the Dachau KZ, where the supply depot was located then, he lived in the old SS hospital. And that's where he talks about, you know, how he lived in this SS hospital for until 1956, from 47 to 56, approximately. And he said there he had all the home comforts one could possibly ask for. He was all very nice, and now he was happier. And one thing he wanted to be sure of always was that he got enough to eat. So he liked working in the mess halls, which he did sometimes. And he was... he was employed as an editor, verifying army requisitions and issuing of military equipment to various units within the Munich subcamp. And he was working for the U.S., or in other words, in my words, he was working for the U.S. Army Command. The administration and depot that he was in was housed in the disbanded War Crimes Tribunal complex. And that hadn't been completed yet at Dachau. It's disbanded now, but it wasn't disbanded then. And he said he did some, he said, I did some research of my own about what had happened from 1933 to 1945. So he was using the records and documents at the War Crimes, American War Crimes Tribunal offices to discover what had happened from 1933 to 1945, which is Hitler's regime. Now, I'm sure, you know, what was he going to get from that? The truth? No. And he didn't. And he published a bunch of stuff that on his blog later that is not the truth, but doesn't seem to bother him. So this is what we find in his blog. And then he met his future wife in 1956. Seems like he met her there, and he followed her to New Zealand. She went to New Zealand, and then he went too, and they got married. And he worked for the Ford Motor Company. And he says, I had a friendly relationship in general with Americans. Now, this is before he went to New Zealand. This is when he was there, you know, after the war, in these jobs he had and so on. He said, I even did some babysitting for one family. And as they all lived in luxury, he means all the Americans, lived in luxury and splendor and had plenty, which many German families at that time lacked. A lot of thievery on a grand scale was going on when I was stationed in Allach and Dachau. Well, thievery would have been going on when these people, when the Germans had access to these people's domiciles and so on, I'm sure, if they, because they lived in luxury and splendor and had plenty of everything, which, you know, which the Germans were still starving. So, I don't find anything too wrong with that, although I don't think his words on a grand scale are accurate, because if it was on a grand scale, it certainly would have been noticed enough or been enough of a problem to do more about. But that it would have been going on, sure, because people are always trying to take care of themselves. You know, this was not greed. This was just survival. So he says he was initially not trusted by some of his colleagues, that is the other Germans who were working for the Americans. And he was told to look the other way in no uncertain terms, because he knew how they were doing what they were doing. And but he says he told them, so he told them he would not report them, but he made it clear that he would not lie if asked about their activities. Then he adds that he did lie once. So he was kind of in between, you know, he was in between working. He was considered a German. He was, he was classed with the Germans. And the Americans saw him as a German. And yet he was, he did not see the Americans he saw them only as people who would, people who would give him an opportunity that he wanted to change his status. So on March 26th, then, 2011, yeah, we've moved away from March 21st, finally, he posts a new and different start, and I'm going to try to get through this as fast as I can. He says that Plyer, this boss of his, he says he doesn't know what he saw in him or why he was so nice to him, but he says, I can only guess he saw a lonely boy who needed parental help. I was 18 years old and in many ways still naive. So he must have been around 16 when he first got into, in 44, and now in 46 he's 18. And I can see he'd be kind of a pathetic figure, but why didn't he try to go home? I don't think he tried to go home. He didn't want to stay in Germany. He was looking to the Americans as his salvation. That's what he was doing. He says this Plyer didn't show any interest in him, but he always saw that he had the kind of work he wanted, and he particularly wanted to work in the mess hall, as I said, because He says, where I could, at, or in a kitchen, where I could at least get a meal, as I did not want to get hungry again. That was the main impression that all that made on him, that being, you know, starving in the, in that Eisenhower camp was too much. And so that was his whole thing, was he wanted to have as much to eat as he could possibly get hold of. And then he brings up something interesting. General Lucius Clay, the deputy to General Eisenhower, he's puts in something honest here, stated, I feel that the Germans should suffer from hunger and from cold, as I believe such suffering is necessary to make them realize the consequences of war which they caused. He goes on saying, U.S. occupation, I don't know if this is him, U.S. occupation forces were under strict orders not to share their food with the German population. This is what Herb is saying. And this also applied to their wives when they arrived later in the occupation. The women were under strict orders not to allow their German maids to get hold of any leftovers. The food was to be destroyed or made inedible. Although this was in the official instructions they were given. Although in view of the starving German population facing them, many housewives or American housewives chose to ignore these official orders. And then just this little thing in August 1944, this is before the end of the war, August 44, a handbook for the military government in Germany was ready, but after reading it, Roosevelt rejected it. I've talked about this in the past. And he ordered a new document drafted. And this new document warned that, the Germans should be allowed to stew in their own juice. Quote, let them have soup kitchens. Let their economy sink. Asked if he wanted the German people to starve. Roosevelt replied, why not? So, and that is exactly the attitude. And that's what happened, too. So he, Herb goes back talking about his work in Allach, which was a town. Later, a famous porcelain factory was put in there. Or maybe it was there before and then got revived. But I did a whole show about that with Charlie Kraft. And I am going to be having Charlie Kraft coming on. Hopefully on March 2nd. Charlie is still in India. In his, he went on a trip there and he extended it. So he's still there and won't be back until March 1st. But I hope that we'll be able to do that show on the 2nd. I have to put it off another week. Anyway, going back to Herb here, he says he's in Allach. And on one of these trips, our driver, James Walters, wanted to show me what those goddamn Germans did during the war. Well, part of his work, Herb's, was, keeping incoming material stored and, requisitioning and handling all the things that they needed, that the Americans needed, you know, the uniforms, bed sheets, getting everything, taking things to the laundry and so on. And so one of their trips to the laundry in Dachau for dry cleaning and washing, this driver was named James Walters, and he said he wanted to show, he was going to show him what these goddamn Germans did. And took him to the Dachau camp and wanted to show him the crematorium there. And this was in mid-1946, Herb says. And Herb says, I was fully aware of the activities of the SD and Einsatzgruppen in Russia. And of course, you know, he's aware of what they said took place in Russia by the Einsatzgruppen. As a youngster, now he says, as a youngster, when my uncle told my parents, I pricked up my ears to listen, that Germans committed mass murder of people that were racially not pure. As the older generation never believed that Hitler could ever win this war, they always felt and said, when no one else was there, and he says this in German, but it is, the retaliation of the victors towards the German people will be indescribable. So this was his family. His family was very anti-Hitler. They believed that, you know, they passed around all the stories about, and there were a lot of Jews in Prussia. I don't know if he's Prussian exactly, but there were a lot of Jews there. And they were kind of accepted previous to the National Socialist regime. And so these stories about the Einsatzgruppen were fully believed and passed around by members of his family. And they said that this war was a bad, bad idea, and that the retaliation of the victors towards the Germans is going to be indescribable. And there was a lot of this thinking. Of course, it ended up true, but this is in large part what led so many Germans who were not, you know, who were not sympathetic to Hitler, to accept everything that was said and to accept the way they were treated too. Because they say, well, we should never have done this to begin with, and now we're getting this punishment. It's Hitler's fault. It's those Nazis' fault, but we're going to have to accept it. And, you know, I don't think that they realized they were going to continue to be accepting it to this day. But it's only the nationalists who are really suffering in Germany today. If you go along with the internationalist regime that's there, you don't feel like you're suffering at all, and you have no desire to defend the past and to defend what I was talking about at the beginning of this show. So it's only the only people with nationalist instincts still, and people with nationalist belief systems. And well, there's a lot that could be said about that, but I'll have to let it wait, probably. Now, so this guy takes them to see the crematorium, and they say, he says, well, he walked down this tree-lined gravel path towards the crematorium. It was almost serene there in Dachau. Well, in the Dachau camp, I mean. Well, it is serene. It's beautiful. I was there, and as I walked down that tree-lined gravel path just a few years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, I thought it was a lovely day, and I thought, what a beautiful place. How, you know, I knew that all the stories were exaggerations or lies, but still, it was still a concentration camp. But I thought, you know, they had a nice surroundings here. This is a beautiful walk with lovely poplar trees on each side, and it's a fairly long walk from the entrance to get to where this crematorium was, is. And he says that as he's walking along there, I noticed first dog kennel type of boxes, three on each side, stacked with flower pots, which he was puzzled about. And he was later told that these were used to hold the ashes of the cremated victims. He and his driver entered a few steps towards the delousing chambers, which had skulls and crossbones on the steel doors. And he said he was curious about the doors, and he was looking at them. Then he says James, the driver, the American, got excited and furious to show me the gas chamber with the description Brausbad written above it. Well, you know, Brausbad means shower bath, and that name was stenciled onto that door to the shower room. I was in that room. It's so obviously a shower room. It's just hard to believe that anybody believes that it was a gas chamber, but they do. Cause when I was there, there were some other people in the room, and they're all looking around with, you know, oh, like, here I am in this gas chamber where all these people were gassed. Oh, you know, and they're just quiet and, you know, looking wide eyed around, and I can't stop myself, and I start commenting to whoever will listen about some of the posters that are written there and about some of the stuff, and people just looking at me like, what is she saying? You know, nobody stopped me, but they couldn't grasp it. And, you know, it's just amazing. These people, they're not stupid. They're not dumb, but they go there thinking they're going to see this fantastic place, piece of history, where there's a gas chamber and crematoriums and so on, this famous place, and they don't want to be disabused of that idea. They want to see that, and they are prepared to believe it, everything they see and read, even though it's if you would even stop to think critically a little bit, you wouldn't. But he says, this guy, Herb, says that he went inside one of the delousing chambers. So he knew they were delousing chambers that had skull and crossbones on the doors. And James closed the door on him, and he was there in the dark. He said that it had some moments of fear. And it was that was before they went into the brow spot. And then he did not quite understand how it could be, you know, what they said. But he said, at the time, I did not think much about its purpose. And the expression Holocaust was not in use. So, yes, at this time, there was just this idea. It wasn't very well developed. And he said that now here. But here he says, writing in 2011, my own opinion now is that the chamber was intended to be used for homicidal purposes, but the installation was never completed or considered impractical, and some internal changes were made to be altered at a later stage. Now, that doesn't sound very intelligent. I don't know where he would get such an idea. It just from trying to explain the official story and not wanting to go against it. The chamber was, this shower room was intended to be used for homicidal purposes, but it was never completed. That is, maybe the gas stuff was never completed. I don't know, you know. He says he was not horrified when he saw the ovens, because for him it was still a matter that cremating the dead as quickly as possible to avoid spreading diseases is the right thing to do. He says how they died in the camp is another matter. And then he reminds us that the last persons cremated in this facility at Dachau were the American was used by the American military to dispose of the 12 Nazi war criminals sentenced to death by hanging at Nuremberg. So that's where these bodies, according to him, of the Nazi war criminals that were hanged, the top ones, were their bodies were cremated here in this in these cremation ovens in Dachau. And well, he says that was the last indignity to them, which was a symbolic act of the Americans. Well, he's got that right, that they should cremate their bodies at Dachau. Then he says, he talks about some of the things he saw there, which were all these propaganda devices that were put up there afterwards by the Americans and shortly afterwards, you know, just like the rack with mannequin inmates bent over it. And a mannequin SS man beating them or something like that for anybody who, for mostly for picture taking. But that's that. And he said that he says he does not recall seeing the so-called chutes that would take Zyklon pellets into the chamber when he was in there in 1946. He says as the buildings were constructed under SS supervision, and their standards, from my own experience, were extremely high, they would never have accepted the shoddy workmanship that was performed on it. The whole thing does not fit in. So he's saying there that there's something wrong with that, with what's being said about those buildings. But he says that, let's see. Well, he says the SS men that he talked to, because there was a lot of SS men that were being held at Dachau, for their trials for a long time. And so I guess he came in contact with them. And they said that the Brausbad wording above the chamber door was, he said it was put on, they said it was put on when the Americans were there. They said, just touch the letters and you will find they're almost fresh in comparison to the rest of the painted wall. So he said he did that, and the impression he had was that it was stenciled and not done by a sign painter. And this is that the U.S. Army vehicles use stencils to put the things on their vehicles, put the names on their vehicles. So, you know, he writes all this. At the same time, he just keeps all this propaganda on his site. Let me see what is still more important to cover. Well, he talks about how things got better when the Cold War started heating up. By 1948, everything was improving for that reason. And he said that Mr. Plyer had not forgotten his plea that he did not want to get hungry again. And he was, place that he was working was no longer, was closed down. And he didn't have a job then. So Mr. Plyer employed him in the mess hall again as a waiter. And he was happy about that. Now somehow he, and I know how he did, he gives a lot of little details, but that might be interesting, but he says that, well, here's a good story that's interesting, but I'm going to skip it for now. He said that when the, at the Dachau, in Dachau trials, when the, now he's talking about the American liberation of Dachau, and he did come to realize what really happened there, and I have something on that further down, but he said that when they were shooting the German guards and so on, killing them and executing them at Dachau, when the Americans took over, right in the beginning there, that this one woman who was there told him about that time, and that her father was an SS fighter at the front and was killed there at the Eastern Front. But she said that when these and he says, okay, Herb says to come to the more serious matter that haunts me to this day are this woman's statements and that of her mother, that the beloved heroic liberators, now he's calling them beloved heroic liberators, he's calling the Americans that. He might be slightly sarcastic here, but I don't think so. Not only committed murder of 500 so-called SS guards, but also dragged other SS personnel out of their villas that had been maintenance people, mechanics and the like, and put them against the wall opposite the main Louisiana Drive and shot them. And this woman said, who was there, who knew about it, she said mothers had given their small children cyanide capsules and told them to take them into their mouths and bite onto them like a lolly or a lollipop as soon as their daddy is shot, because they had families, their families were there, and they were took their men, and they knew they were going to be executed. And so the women thought there was no hope for them or their families, so they were having their children bite into these cyanide capsules. And she said that 20 young children died this way before the Americans realized what was happening and the shooting was stopped. So I guess, you know, there would have been even more. These people don't take into account what the ramifications of their actions are, these Americans. They were just absolute brutes, you know, and absolute savages coming in there with their self-righteousness. But I still say that Herb is a Nestbeschmutzer. He's a Nestbeschmutzer. That's a well-known German word. I might not be pronouncing it real well. For a person who runs down or denigrates one's own family and country. And that's what he does continually. Because he says that he was looking for these graves of all these SS guards, but he didn't find them, and he didn't go beyond the fence to look for them. He didn't want to take it any further, so he didn't want to be a person who would really reveal all of this that this woman had told him. about. So now he goes to his living conditions and says that he's happy with his accommodation in the old SS hospital and had all the comforts of home. Now he's repeating stuff here that he's already said at the end of this post here, the end of this entry, and talks about, okay, let me just pass this by. Now, his next post is Camp Dachau U.S. Army Facility. Saturday, April 23rd, 2011, he posted this. But he's got a list of 27 facilities that he says he's going to show you where they are. Then he's got a map and an aerial view of the camp. And it's got numbers on it, but it's only got 8 numbers. So he only goes through the first 8, and then it stops. And we don't get to find out where the War Crimes Tribunal building was, or the holding block for war criminals was. Maybe they've demolished that, but still he could show where it was. We don't get to see where the bakery was, where the swimming pool was. That was all changed by the Americans, it's true. We don't get to see the U.S. Army stockade or the refugee camp or any of that stuff. So I didn't know what the purpose of that post was. It was a big disappointment. So on August 13th, 2011, he has a new entry, Dachau KZ, Suffering and Death. Now, here's where I really want to point out what's wrong what's wrong with Herb, not everything that's wrong with him. Because there was plenty before. But he has, he is giving the official story, official camp memorial story of Dachau KZ and how much suffering the victims, the inmates experienced and how much death there was here and so on. He is doing that directly from the official records that are there. Which of course are written by communists and the communists that control that memorial now, and from the communist Russian point of view, not from the truth. But he's got a long entry here that just copies from this what he found there in the Dachau records, official records. And he starts it out by saying that the camp was a model for many other concentration camps to be built right through German-occupied Europe during World War II. I do believe this is not his writing. This is what he's copying. And it says, the essence of the National Socialist rule was a system of terror that spread right through the network of 24 main camps with about 1,000 sub-camps where opponents to the regime were exploited, tortured, at the mercy of SA, SS, and police auxiliary, which often resulted in death. But now, Herb says a little bit about himself. He gives a little something here that he signs, and he says, as for myself, I had a cosmopolitan upbringing during the Third Reich. We had French and Russian POWs on the estate, never considered Russians as Untermenschen, subhumans. In both cases, they taught me their languages, both the French and the Russians, something that was not condoned by the regime. Well, I don't know, but he's admitting that he had a cosmopolitan upbringing. He was from a wealthy, had to be from a wealthy family. They had an estate. And so he was generally had an international view. He would not have been, his whole family would have been very much against Hitler and the Nazis, and that was just bred into him, and he has never changed that. He, even though I don't know what happened to his family and his estate, I don't know why he didn't go back there, but he didn't. And so that's he signs this. He says he dedicates this narrative to two young Indian brothers, Arjuni and Varun, who will tour Germany as part of their school curriculum. And then at at the end of another one, if I go way down here, I'll never find my place again, but he does it again. He dedicates to some Indian, to children in India who have to sleep on the footpaths, as he puts it. So he's taken up, you know, some kind of a supportive or, you know, financial help to youths in India. And that's just typical of these kinds of Germans. He can't take up the cause of his own people because he thinks he doesn't much like him, or he wants to get away from them, and he also prefers to be international in his thinking. So back to I have to find my place again. I still have a lot to say. Suffering and death. All right, so here he is. He says, about Dachau, this is the official report, kind of. The initial tolerable conditions within the camp were not of a long duration. On April 1st, 1933, Himmler rose to the command of the political police in Bavaria and assumed all rights in this area of responsibility as leader of the SS. So he's got a thing against Himmler, too. He paints Himmler in the worst possible light. He says here on April, well, he's not saying this. I don't think he's saying this. I think this is just taken directly, because it's very long, and it's just taken directly from this probably little history of Dachau. That's the official camp history. On April 10th, the SS unit took control of the camp and murdered, a few days later, four Jewish inmates under the pretext of an alleged attempted escape. This SS captain was responsible, and this was a, you know, he calls it murder. And then he says that, you know, he's talking about how he uses words like draconian application of the death penalty, or an excuse for just a killing, for minor infringements. And this is the way that this is just talked about, as to what the way things were handled at Dachau before the war, long before the war. And I just don't believe it. It wasn't like that from all accounts, you know, of more fair-minded accounts that I've ever read. It was very different from that, but this is the way the official story goes. And he says Himmler's idea was a state within a state with its own laws, you know, with its own leader, and to commit violence. All they wanted to do there was commit violence on whoever was in the camp. And then he talks about a bunch of stuff here, which I'm going to have to skip. Oh, my God, I've only got 5 minutes. All right, less than that. All right, 4 minutes, if that. So then we go to he talks about the church, too. This thing talks about the church. Well, let me just skip that. So this is what the story about Dachau is. It just goes on and on, focuses on the cruelties and, you know, gives a bunch of examples of things, and it focuses upon inmate society, summarizes it up about how, you know, that the people of Germany voted. Even the people who were incarcerated in the camp had voted for the Hitler regime. And then but finally he comes upon this American massacre at Dachau, which he just learned about in 2012, and he posts this in October. He learned about this at Scrapbook Pages blog, obviously. And so he did a pretty good, well, he copied all of that, the story of that, and did a good job of that, I will say. And he lists here the victims of the American massacre at Dachau. That is, they came and massacred all the German officials that were there. They shot on the spot 122. 40 were killed by inmates. 12, these are guards, mostly. 12 were shot by somebody named Birdeye, and 346 were shot by Lieutenant Bushyhead. I'm sorry. And the total is 520. The 10 of them fell during the fighting. And he gives his sources for this, which is Metapedia, Wikipedia, Scrapbook Pages blog, and H. Lindberger. That's worth reading. But then this man, after he's finished with Dachau and has nothing more to say, and his blog is about Dachau, and Dachau was the only place that he was at, he then goes on to talk about Auschwitz. And once again, on September 30th, 2011, he posts as a new very long post, Auschwitz, the powerful and the helpless. And it again is taken directly from official records, which he maybe, you know, edited a little bit or something. But it's full of the Russian story about Auschwitz. And in fact, he says, where do I find it? Here it is. He says that material I am using in the following narrative is written by a number of researchers sponsored and published under the auspices of the Cultural Foundation of the German Federal Republic. The German Federal Republic was the communist German Democratic Republic that existed from the 1950s until 1968, and then they started using the term BRD. But it's all Russian propaganda, and he says it's also taken from the Alfred Krupp von Bohlen and Halbach and its foundation, which turned very anti-Nazi. Alfred, the Krupp company was working, under the Nazis, but afterwards, you know, they try to say they weren't, so they would go along with all this propaganda. And so he says that this is where it comes from. And after he does his big, long, long, long post about Auschwitz, which is just, as I said, propaganda, then he goes on to Buchenwald and does the same thing with Buchenwald, and later he goes on to Mauthausen. And, you know, so now here he's putting, well, I'm out of time, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of this. I got this off my chest, and probably I might write it up in order to put it on paper. And thanks for again, and I'll see you next week. Carolyn Yeager with Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.